Welcome to The Psychology of Success. I'm Caden Terry, and each week I help young hustlers actualize their infinite potential by featuring interviews with world-class leaders in business, sports, and health. Now let's get into The Psychology of Success.
All right, welcome back to The Psychology of Success podcast. I'm super pumped. Today I have Larry Beardall on the show. So a little bit of background on Larry. He was my mission president in Seattle. So in our church, a lot oftentimes the young men and young women will serve missions to go share more about Jesus Christ and more about the gospel, and we give up everything. And you guys have heard me talk about that a lot on the show and the different life skills and business principles I learned. A lot of those I learned from my mission, specifically from Larry. It was amazing when I got to the mission, because I remember how nervous I was, and I was, because you leave your family and leave your businesses and everything. And I showed up to the airport. There's probably 30 other missionaries there, cookie cutter, all the same people, basically. And I thought, well, this guy, no way he's going to know me. He came right up to me and called me by my first name. And he knew my name. He already knew me. And, you know, as I watched President Beardall throughout the mission, I learned so many leadership principles that I've been able to apply now. And mostly everything that you guys hear, I learned from him. So I'm excited to dive more into his business background and more of his leadership. So grateful to have you on.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah.
We had the opportunity to serve with 753 missionaries, none that were any better than you were. And so this is a pleasure for me to be here today.
Well, thank you. Yeah, so excited. So let's get into it. We've talked a little bit. I mean, I'm excited for today because on the mission, we didn't talk too much business, but I'm excited today to learn more about your background. Tell us maybe where you grew up and how you got into business, how you got to where you are today.
All right. Well, it was a roundabout way, which probably isn't too unusual. But I'm a rural Utah boy, lived in Heber City, Fillmore, and Price, so never in any big cities. After my mission, I went to BYU and graduated from BYU with a degree in finance. My wife, Laurie, and I moved to Durham, North Carolina, where I went to work for a company called GTE Corporation. They were later acquired by Verizon, so that's name isn't recognizable today. And spent the first 4 years of my career in finance, in budgeting, internal auditing, accounting, and those kinds of things. And what I learned from that experience was that's not what I wanted to do in my life. And so it was interesting, after about 4 years there, I got a phone call one day, late 1983, from my brother-in-law, who was playing professional football at the time in Houston, Texas, for the Houston Oilers, now the Tennessee Titans.
So awesome. Gifford Nielsen, right?
Gifford Nielsen.
We cleaned his garbage cans the other day.
Yes, you did. And you did a good job.
That was good.
I inspected them the other day, and they
smell like lavender. Probably not by now. But
you could eat out of them. So go Bin Blasters.
Yeah.
Anyway, he called up one day and he said, "Hey, I got this great idea. Sell your house, quit your job, and pick up your family and move to Houston, and we're going to start this little company." And I was about 27 years old at the time, just young enough probably to actually think about that seriously. And so my wife and I considered it and prayed about it and decided to do exactly that. The business was an interesting one. He was drafted by the Oilers in 1978, and he played as a backup to Dan Pastorini, who was a pretty recognizable figure in those days in NFL. Anyway, the Oilers were playing the Pittsburgh Steelers in the last regular season game of the year. They'd already qualified for the playoffs. They were going to the Orange Bowl the next week to play the, can't remember who they were going to play. Anyway, in that football game, the Steelers broke four of Dan Pastorini's ribs. And
jeez.
So, you know, the fans are going, great, we're going to the playoffs for the first time in forever. And now our starting quarterback's in the hospital with four broken ribs. Well, there was an inventor in Houston by the name of Byron Donzus, who had a contract with the Army at that time to develop a cushioning system for flak jackets for helicopter pilots in Vietnam. And the idea there was that the flak jacket would protect the shrapnel and so forth, but there was still the injury occurring from the blunt trauma of the impact. And his contract was to come up with a cushioning system that would prevent that from happening. Well, he got thinking about, well, if I can protect a pilot's ribs, why couldn't I protect a football player's ribs? So he went back into his workshop and fashioned up what he thought might work for a quarterback. And it was the very first flak jacket that was ever worn by anybody in the NFL. And so he grabbed his buddy and they snuck into Methodist Hospital where Dan Pastorini was. His buddy had this is December of 1978, probably.
Mm-hmm.
He had a baseball bat. His buddy did it under his coat. And Byron put this flak jacket on under his coat. They snuck into Dan Pastorini's room. Byron took off his jacket, raised his arms, and his buddy took his baseball bat out and started wailing on him in the ribs. Well, Pastorini's first thought was that some rabid Steeler fans were there to finish him off. Long story short, they equipped him with this flak jacket. He played in the games, threw 4 touchdown passes. The Oilers won and advanced into the playoffs. And the rest is history. Byron Donzas ended up on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and it was quite a big deal. Well, moving forward a few years, Byron's in the locker room with the Oilers, and Giff's talking to him about house business, what are you doing with the product, and so forth. And it came to the point where he admitted that they weren't really doing very much with it. It was a great idea, but they couldn't figure out really what to do with it and how to market it and how to get it out in mass. So we acquired the marketing rights to this particular product, formed a company, and I and one other fellow who was a schoolmate of Giff's in Provo growing up formed a company in Houston, and we went to work selling this product to not only the NFL teams, but expanded into Major League Hockey, professional baseball, and any sport that had any kind of contact to it at all. And it was a dream deal.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in every locker room, every NFL locker room, most of the major college locker rooms, and I was kind of like pinching myself, like, I can't believe I'm doing this. And you won't believe this, but this is before he won 4 Super Bowls, but Joe Montana was our very first spokesperson for the product. He was on the cover of the brochure that we had. And so that gave me my very first taste of starting a business from the ground up and watching it grow and having some success with it. That business lasted for a few years. We wanted to actually acquire the manufacturing rights so we could take it the direction we wanted to,
yep.
And that failed. And so we decided if we couldn't have total control of the entire operation, that we would sell our part of it. And so we sold it to Easton and then moved on. But it was interesting. Not only was it a lot of fun, but I was a finance guy. And about 6 months into this, the other fellow who was the marketing and sales guy decided to, this wasn't for him. I don't really remember why. Mm-hmm. So he left, and so was me. And so I just picked up the marketing sales part of the business. It didn't take me long to realize that's what I really enjoyed doing. Mm. That was the fun part of the whole experience. And so
you mentioned that you sold it to Easton, like the baseball mm-hmm. company.
Yes.
So as far as I understand, explain the product again. The quarterbacks would wear it on their chest. And it was like a hard shield, basically?
So there was a hard plastic shell on the exterior, and then underneath that was about an inch of foam padding with what they call the padded air management system. And so as you compress that, the air would slowly leak out of that, and so it was a nice cushioning system. Easton was interested in it because we were selling it to professional baseball for shin guards for batters. And they wanted to expand beyond baseball and get into football equipment. And so they saw that as the opportunity to do so.
Okay.
So anyway.
Wow.
It was fun while it lasted.
That's surreal. What was it like being around all those NFL players?
It was a lot of fun. I mean, it's, you know, I, remember Jim Kelly, for example. This is before he played for the Bills. He was playing for the Houston Gamblers. There was back then, as there typically has always been, there was always another professional football league that didn't ever seem to last very long. But he was playing for the Houston Gamblers, and the trainer would call up and say, "Come on in and measure him. We want to get him set up." And so it's shoulder pads, rib protector, and everything else is needed. And I mean, Heisman Trophy winners, Mike Rozier from Nebraska back in that day. These are names that you don't even recognize.
Yeah, but still, Heisman Trophy winner. I mean,
yeah. And so it was
it. Holy crap!
It was a scream. And so anytime any of these teams would come into Houston to play the Oilers, you know, we'd have the opportunity to go to dinner the night before with the athletic training staff and equipment managers and so forth. And so it was just a lot of fun. But the most important part of that whole experience, well, maybe two things. Number one was I went from a Fortune 100 company to a startup where it was just nothing, starting from scratch. And secondly, that it just by sheer accident really launched me from the finance side of things to the marketing and sales side of things, which is really where I spent the rest of my career and where that was the real love for me in business. So very fortuitous in many ways.
Yeah. Okay, so you sell the company. What was next after that?
So this is mid-1980s in Houston, Texas. At the time, there were the oil and gas industry was in a recession. And so there were, you know, 90-some-odd homes for sale in our subdivision, and people were just, you know, walking away from their homes. I mean, it was just, we thought, you know, it was not a great place to do something else at that time in Houston. It didn't feel like, and we thought, well, we're both from Utah. Let me take a trip to Utah and see if there's anything there of any interest. And so I hopped on a plane and flew to Salt Lake, and I had lunch with a former missionary, never a companion, but a friend from the mission field, Kelvin Cullimore, and his father had started this little company called Dynatronics a few years earlier, and he had acquired a low-power laser that was used for biostimulation for medical purposes from an 18-year-old young man in Pittsburgh, Kansas, who had started this company in his garage. Didn't take it anywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And somehow Kelvin Sr. found out about this and acquired this product. Well, the problem was it didn't have FDA approval. And so the company just really wasn't, they were just spending all of their time and money trying to get this approval from the FDA so they could take this product to market, which never happened until about 10 years later. But long story short, Kelvin said, "My dad's looking for somebody to, we've got to get some products, we've got to get some distribution, we've got to, you know, if we don't do something else, this thing's not going to last. Would you be interested?" I thought, why not? Gets us back to Salt Lake. And so there were four or five employees at the time, not really anything in terms of sales with the company, but thought, what a great opportunity. I've got this taste now for, you know, use the ground floor business. And it was kind of related a little bit to what I had done before in Houston. And I thought, this is perfect. So we went to work. And 5 years later, we were named to Inc. Magazine's list of 100 fastest growing public companies.
Oh, wow.
And so that was fun. We just had tremendous growth through those first 5 years.
You took it public that fast?
It was public before I joined the company, because they went public in order to raise money, in order to do the research to try to get this laser product approved.
Okay.
And they were running out of money trying to get this approval. And so with what money they had left, they wanted to get into something that they could run with. And so that was the whole idea of bringing me on board. And we were enjoying just tremendous success.
Incredible.
Ground floor, once again, building mostly national distribution, but some international distribution. and doing all of the marketing and product development, and probably found that within the marketing niche, that product development was really one of the things I thoroughly enjoyed. You know, just identifying the need for identifying a problem that needed to be solved. Our target markets were primarily the physical therapy market, but also anybody in physical medicine, really. Athletic training, chiropractic, anything that was physical medicine related. And so it was really a matter of identifying a need and trying to develop a product that would fill it. And that's how we grew the company. And so it was a scream. I tell people all the time, for the last 40 some odd years, I've never worked a day in my life. There was never one day the alarm went off in the morning where I said, oh gosh, I've got to go to work today. It never once felt like a job. Never once felt like something that was going to be, you know, just a really drag of a day to do. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's, and I stayed there for 30 plus years until right before we got our mission call. And, my partner and I sold the majority share of the company. The investment banking group came in and acquired the majority of the company. And
right before you left for the mission?
Yeah, it was a couple of years before I left.
It's good timing.
So I hung on. I stayed around for a year and then spent the last little bit of time working with my son who was in the same business. And then the mission call came. So we were off to bigger and better things.
Yeah. Wow. So, and we're going to dive into that in a second. I can't wait to hear about the mission and share that with the listeners. There's so much to dive into here. Like, so kind of looking back. So Laurie, I absolutely love, you know, I consider her, I joke around, she's my third mom, right? Because I have my mom, then my stepmom, then Laurie. But it's like, I'm thinking about your story. So you graduate college, right? And then you're working for that company. You got a solid job. And then this opportunity with your brother-in-law comes up and tells you, hey, drop everything. I want you to move here to be a part of this startup, this idea that I have. And like in my mind, like if I were to approach my wife with an opportunity like that, like when I'm married, I don't know if she would buy in. Like I don't know how I could convince her to trust me to give up this secure job to go do my own thing. So how did she react to that? And how did you convince her? How did it work out?
I didn't really have to convince her. Before I answer that question directly, let me give you a little bit of background. I used to tell our missionaries in their exit interviews when we would get in, you know, as they were preparing to leave their missions, we would talk about dating and marriage and those kinds of things. And I would always, we'd talk about several different things, but I would say, whatever you do, marry up. Find somebody that's way above you, somebody you really don't deserve, and then do everything you can to deserve her. And I did that very thing. I mean, it worked for me. So I married the greatest woman on the planet. Yeah. And so, and, you know, we may talk a little bit more about this later on, but, you know, we have really centered our lives on trying to follow the will of the Lord. That's been a very important part to us. Mm-hmm. And so we were very prayerful about that and just felt like that was something that we needed to do. And yeah, from the outside looking in, you know, I think that was probably the only time in my life I would have done something like that. The older I got and the less likely I would have ever been to do something that was as risky as that was, but at that point it didn't seem like a huge risk, and it was an opportunity to not only do something new and exciting, but to be around family a little bit, which was attractive to us as well, because we were living out in North Carolina, we had family nowhere near us, and so that was a little bit attractive too, but we felt very good about it. It didn't take any convincing, really.
So I know in business, I mean, there's so many ups and downs, and that's another concern I have. And I'm sure a lot of my listeners, because all my listeners, a lot of them are young hustlers, as I like to call them, ages like 16 to 30, right? A lot of them aren't married or they're about to be married or they're newlyweds. And a big concern I have for when I'm married is those ups and downs in business, right? With income, emotionally, everything. And so could you walk us through maybe like an example of that in business and in your life of maybe one of the down times and how you stayed, you know, positive and how you and your wife grew together in that moment? So I'm so curious.
Well, you know, as you're going to find out, you're sort of just getting started, relatively speaking, at least to where I'm at in terms of age and so forth. But you're never going to really enjoy the hard times. But you're the more often that happens, you're going to start understanding that those are really valuable experiences. And that once again, the common thread that's going to run through, you know, all of this is just really trusting in the Lord. And so we had several hard times, some really challenging times financially and other things in our lives. And we just always knew that if we just did what we knew was right and kept moving forward, everything would work out, and it always did. And every time we got on the back side of one of those experiences, we could look back and say, we could understand why, for the most part, at least for some of the reasons why those experiences, why we needed some of those experiences and how it really benefited us. And so, and they continue, just because you get to a certain spot in your life, and maybe more financially secure and those kinds of things, the challenges continue. Mm. And so it's just a part of life. And so I would say learning to embrace the challenge, learning to embrace the difficult time, understanding that, you know, it's not all going to collapse and disappear, and trying to understand what it is you need to learn from it, because that's where you really learn. And sometimes you have to go through some tough times to really get things fixed the way they need to be fixed, and whether it's in your business or whatever it might be. So anyway, I'm a naturally optimistic person. I always think tomorrow is going to be better than today. As good as today is, I think the best is yet to come. As good as my life has been, I don't have any desire to go back and live any of it over again. I'm anxious for what's coming. And so that's helpful as well, to have a really positive, optimistic attitude about things, no matter what's going on around you. Mm. And so anyway, but marry the right person.
How do you find
that? Because if you don't, it's going to be.
So this is good. My listeners are curious about this. How do we find the right person? I mean, how do you know?
Well, maybe we could spend the rest of this discussion talking about that, but just short and sweet. You need to find somebody. I mean, you're going to start with somebody that you're attracted to. I mean, that's just where it starts.
Of course,
that's the easy part. Yeah, that happens. You don't even have to think about that part. But you've got to find somebody whose priorities and values and desires and goals and dreams align with yours. That doesn't mean you've got to like all the same kinds of food and you both like to play golf or whatever. Fortunately, my wife does like to play golf.
In fact, we golfed a little bit ago and it was fun. He's pretty good.
She's awesome. And don't ever play her in ping pong.
Ping pong, really?
She'll take you to the cleaners.
So. I would never guess that. What the heck?
She's a tennis player.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But anyway, if you can find somebody who shares the same aspirations and goals and more importantly, the values that you want the same things out of life, and you can communicate with each other and you can share openly about things and make sure that you can do that before you ever pop the question, and make sure that your goals are lining up pretty well, and make sure you can communicate with each other. And be really honest with each other. If those things are in place, then you're in pretty good shape.
As you're talking about that, it reminds me of my mission and the same principles that would create an effective companionship, right? Because as missionaries, for the people that don't know, You live with someone and you're with them basically 24/7. So for me, it was, I had what, probably 8 or 9 different companions, different guys that I'd be with for 6 to 12 weeks with each other 24/7. And these same principles, I realized that as I followed them, we would have a successful companionship. So the little things like communicating openly, being honest, uplifting each other, like silly things like that, even though it sounds weird with another guy, it's so true. And now it applies with dating and marriage, which is awesome. And then, so that's what I'd love to get into now, is like more of the mission and the principles that you learned there. And I guess before that, the principles you learned in business, then how you're able to apply them in the mission and how they connected. Because we were talking a little bit off air about that, how it's all one thing.
It is all one thing. And I appreciate you making that connection. And that's been one of the things that's been a foundational belief for me, and that is that there's no separating the temporal and the spiritual, at least there hasn't been in my life. I didn't always understand that, you know, especially when I was your age, I really didn't get that. But if you can understand that the spiritual side of things permeates every part of what you do, business and other relationships and everything else going on in your life, then there's not this battle and conflict going on all the time between
a balance.
You know, gotta, you know, my, you know, it's
I feel that.
It's all one thing. I mean, it's all one thing. And so why would your Heavenly Father be less interested in your success in business or any other aspect of your life as you would be in serving a mission or serving in the church or whatever it might be? He's not less interested. I mean, this is all part of the experience that you need to have. And so regardless of where your listeners may fall on the spiritual side of things in their lives, I would invite them to understand that that's a very valuable thing. And as if they can bring those two things together, things get much easier in everything that they do.
Mm. You know, it's the same exact principles. It's crazy. I talk about that on the podcast quite a bit. The same exact things I learned on the mission, I apply them now into business and into life, and it all works. I mean, it's all the same stuff that you taught me, right? And so it's incredible seeing that pattern. So you went from, so at your company, right before you went on the mission, how many people were you leading, would you say?
Oh.
Or how many employees?
Well, I mean, in terms of the, I was the executive vice president of marketing and sales. And so in that part of the company, it fluctuated, but probably at the time that I left, probably 100 probably would be.
Okay. So you have 100 people that you're helping and you're coaching, you're leading, and then you get to the mission and you said you had over 700, right? You guys counted?
Fortunately, not all at the same time.
It was about 200 at one point, like
we
one
were,
point in time.
240
was the max.
Was the max, and we were over 200 most of the time that we were there because of COVID.
So, because I want to dive more into your leadership principles and your style, you know, what do you think is the best way to lead people?
Well, as you might remember, our motto was high love, high expectations. And I would say that fits missionary work, fits business, fits family, fits everything. If you're too far on one end of that spectrum or the other, then you get way out of balance. I mean, if it's all high expectations and there's no love, there's no team building, there's no positive feedback, there's nothing going on that side, people tire quickly of that and become cynical and burn out. And if it's the opposite, if you're spending all your time just trying to make sure everybody feels good and is happy, but you have no expectation for them, then of course that's not going to work either. And so it's really balancing those two things together. We found, and I've not just in the mission, but you know, throughout my life and leadership, that people like high expectations. People love to be challenged. People love it when you think that they can be more than they are, or they can do more than they're doing, that they can progress and grow. They like that. Most do. Not every single person, but most do. Most thrive in that kind of an environment. But it has to be backed up with an equal amount of love and support and, we spent a lot of time doing that. And I don't know how successful we were at balancing those two things, but that was our goal, to really try and balance those things. Sometimes Sister Beardall or Laurie was more the love side.
With her caramels. I was going to say that. You guys balanced. It was perfect. We'd leave different meetings and we'd get these homemade caramels. In fact, I went over to their house, Larry's house, a month ago. We cleaned his garbage cans and he gave Jackson some homemade caramels and some lemonade. So he definitely felt the love then. So I think you guys balanced it great. Yeah, it was good.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Sometimes we wish we could have a do-over, but I say that the next thing is that I've always believed that people can change. I've always believed that, wherever you are now, things can be different, things can be better. And in this particular case, missionary work, that is unbelievably challenging. I mean, we're taking 18, 19, 20-year-olds, in many cases, who have never left home before. And in some cases, not in your case, but in some cases, people have never worked very hard. I mean, they've kind of sort of had it handed to them a little bit through most of their life, and haven't really had to work. And missionary work is work, and so it's a challenging thing. We recognized early on we couldn't solve everybody's problems. I mean, not every, but many missionaries were homesick. Many missionaries had all kinds of different, that they'd leave their girlfriend at home and, whatever, and a host of other issues. And we couldn't possibly deal with all of those problems and solve everybody's problems. And so we learned quickly that we had to do a couple of things. Number one was we had to connect them with their Savior, Jesus Christ, who could solve all of those problems and fix all those things. We couldn't, but He could. And just helping them make that connection was monumental. And that was really the key to everything, to the extent a missionary could do that. And you were a wonderful example of that. And I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. And the other thing is that I've never felt like I ever had all the answers. And so I'm not just for the purpose of team building, but also I want to hear what everybody has to say. I want everybody's input. I want everybody in the group, everybody in the discussion, to feel like they've got an equal voice to make suggestions or provide feedback or positive or negative. And I love just that group dynamic of everybody working together. And MLCs, Mission Leadership Councils in the mission, were absolutely, bar none, my favorite meeting of the month, where you could bring in the entire leadership of the mission and talk about things and how to do things better and learn from our missionaries. And that was so energizing to me. I never saw that as a one-way exchange. I always saw that as a two-way exchange, and that was a wonderful thing. You did something quite interesting that was, nobody had done it before, and I'm
really
not sure if anybody's done it since. But I remember you called up one day, or maybe it was in your weekly letter, I don't remember, but you said, would it be okay? You were a brand new zone leader at the time, and you said, I think you were in Seattle, and you said, would it be okay if I reached out to the parents of the missionaries that I go on exchanges with, that I, you do a 24-hour exchange with a younger missionary typically. And I just would really like to reach out to their parents and kind of let them know what I think of their son and some of his qualities and how he's doing and so on and so forth. And when you asked that question, I thought, whoa, we've got somebody. Now, there is a principle of leadership that you don't ever see typically at that age. And I was very, very impressed by that. And I'm sure the parents of the missionaries were very impressed by that and very much appreciated it. But that's a perfect example of, you know, you're in that case a leader, you're a zone leader working with a younger missionary. But what you're doing in that particular example is you are building them up and you're helping them understand that they've got somebody who's watching over them, who's not just their leader, but who loves them and who really wants them to be successful and to succeed, not just in missionary work, but in life. And that's a perfect example of the kinds of things that leadership, effective leadership, is really all about. It's not a one-way deal. It's you as a individual will never grow as a leader unless those you're serving grow with you. Mm-hmm. If they don't grow, then you're not progressing or growing either. So anyway.
Appreciate that. Yeah, I saw that need because in my mind I was like, well, like I talk to my parents every P day, you know, once a week on Monday, and they hear how I'm doing, but they don't really hear from anyone else how I'm actually doing, right? And so I thought, man, for the missionaries that really, even anyone that I want an exchange with, I wanted to give their parents a look at how their son, or I didn't do sister missionaries, just for the elders, but
most good to
yeah. But so I'd message the elders' parents, and because it'd give them a perspective of someone that was actually there, right? And it worked wonders. I loved it because a lot of times in leadership, at very first, and you know this, I mean, people just seem to like not like you. Some people just despise you just because you're their leader, quote unquote. But once they get to know you and that you're just another person, you're there to help them, to grow with them, that's when I've realized it just clicks. And so that helped a ton to help them realize, like, look, like I'm not here to tell you what to do. Let's just grow together. So appreciate that.
Well, you listeners, tear that page out of Caden's playbook and use that to build your team. Things like that. It's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good job.
Yeah. Thanks. So, a follow up question for that is like, with leadership, I mean, because I just love uplifting and serving and inspiring the people that I lead. But oftentimes, when they don't live up to your expectations, I mean, how do you go in and coach them? I don't like to use the word correct, but how do you help them when they're not living up to the expectation that you've set? It's such a hard thing for me to do naturally.
That is a hard thing to do. but if you've laid the foundation beforehand, and sometimes you're not able to do that because this might be a newer kind of a relationship that you're dealing with. But if you have laid the proper foundation and that individual really understands that you really are concerned about them, that you really want it, that you want what is in their best interest, that this isn't about you and trying to make you look better. This is really, you're invested in them. And that example we talked about just a minute ago is a perfect example of that. Then you've got a lot more latitude to be able to talk freely and directly to somebody about issues. And I remember in interviews when a missionary was obviously not doing, you know, what they needed to do or performing to the level that not only that I felt that they should be, but that I knew they probably felt that they should be. I would kind of turn the tables on them a little bit. I would just say, Elder or Sister, are you happy with where things are? Do you feel like you're where you need to be? Do you feel like there's changes you need to make in your life and your service? And if so, where are those things? If you were to be perfectly honest, where do you think you're falling short, and where could you do better? And asking questions like that typically leads to a discussion where they can let their guard down. You're not accusing them of anything. You're not being critical. You're not calling them out on a particular thing. You're really opening the door for them to do some self-evaluation and to hopefully be honest. And 9 times out of 10, going down that path results in something very, very effective, because they know better than you do when they're falling short, and you know the areas where they really need to improve. So that's those weren't hard discussions to have, really.
That is a gold nugget right there for the listeners. So to kind of break that down, so he's saying that when you have these crucial conversations that are hard to have, when you need to coach someone on your team or whatever, you always help them bring it up on their own in a way, or to realize it on their own rather than accusing them, because it could not be true in the first place, right? But if you can help them to where you just ask the open question, I love that, the open question. It's like, what do you think you could do better? Like, how can I help you with what we got going right now in the business with driving the bin blaster truck? Like, what do you think we could do more effectively? You know, I love that, because then it's not, their guard goes down, right?
Absolutely. Then they recognize you're there, as you said, you're there to help them. You're not there to judge them in any way. So they're not defensive and not putting up their guard. And they'll typically open up and be very honest with you. And those discussions typically end up being some of the best discussions you'll ever have, because at the end of all of that, look what you've ended up with. Now you've arrived at really where you wanted to get to, and they got you there. You know, it was really them that recognized and were honest about those things, and so you didn't have to come down on them in any way. And so I honestly, I don't know that I looked forward to those discussions, but I didn't shy away from them at all, because I knew that they were going to be, in most cases, very, very uplifting and strengthening to both of us.
So you finished your mission. I mean, you were there during COVID, right? And I couldn't imagine what that would have been like. Were you there like before the pandemic actually happened? Like it was happened while you were there?
Yeah, we arrived in July of 2019, and COVID hit in March of 2020. So we had about 8 or 9 months of normal missionary work.
Getting used to being in the mission field.
That's right.
We're
still learning everybody's names and how to get from point A to point B and where to get food. And so... yeah, that was, looking back on that, I'm glad we served during COVID, because the experiences were phenomenal. I mean, the things that we learned during that were unbelievably valuable. And I don't know if we have time for this or not, but
absolutely.
I'll give you a couple of examples of that. We went into quarantine, state of Washington mandated. We were serving in the Washington-Seattle mission. State of Washington mandated that that people stay home beginning, I think, the third week in March.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you've got 180 young men and young women who were, you know, you want out working and doing missionary work, and all of a sudden they're locked in their apartments indefinitely. And you're thinking, this is the worst possible scenario you could possibly dream of. And so there were some sleepless nights there, but it was interesting, because this is the Lord's work and not ours, and for which we were so grateful. The first full week that we were in quarantine, we taught our missionaries in our mission taught lessons, not just made contacts, taught lessons in 30 states and 40 different countries in a 7-day period. We had this great big, our assistants had this great big world map out, and we were putting pins in it because we had to pivot immediately to social media. We couldn't go knock on anybody's doors. We couldn't visit members. We couldn't do anything that we were accustomed to doing. And we couldn't leave the apartment. And so we were forced to do it a different way, and we immediately pivoted. Now, all of those tools were available to us prior to COVID, but we didn't use them very much because we were just locked into doing it other ways.
Yeah, I didn't really have the need.
And so, boom, I mean, week one, we're just off to the races, and the work didn't slow down at all. And success was happening literally around the world. And so we were zooming into baptisms, you know, in different countries around the world.
Yeah.
And so I'd be out for my run in the morning, and, you know, I'm listening to something taking place in somewhere halfway around the world. Mm-hmm. And so that was the amazing thing, number one, and I could spend hours talking about this.
Yeah.
Maybe just one other thing quickly. Because of all of the mission, there were 32,000 missionaries that were serving internationally from North America that had to be repositioned, had to come home as a result of COVID. And then they could either stay home and wait up to 18 months and hopefully go back to their original assignment, or they could immediately opt to be reassigned domestically. That's when the surge happened, when we got all of these missionaries. But the amazing thing was, we weren't just getting bodies. We were getting, in many cases, especially at the front end of COVID, we were getting all of these experienced language-speaking missionaries from all over the world. One quick little thing that maybe will illustrate the magnitude of what happened here. Some of the first missionaries that came in had been in Brazil. So they were Portuguese-speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't have any Portuguese-speaking missionaries in our mission. We didn't know we had any Portuguese speakers in the mission. And they immediately started advertising English classes on Facebook for native Portuguese speakers to learn English. The first class, they had 32 people sign up and come. And within 6 months, a Portuguese unit was established up in Totem Lake. And on the first Sunday that we met, there were 52 people in attendance. And that was just one of many miracles that happened because of COVID, because we had things that we didn't have before. We had people who could speak Portuguese. We didn't have those before. Same thing happened in the Mandarin Chinese branch. That branch just exploded. We went from one Mandarin-speaking missionaries to 16 Mandarin-speaking missionaries. We could deploy them all over the greater Seattle area, which we couldn't have done before. And all of a sudden, the branch just exploded, and now is a ward. Those are just two examples. And I guess the purpose of just touching on those is understanding that you're going to have things like that happen to you in your business, where all of a sudden, wham, I mean, something dramatic's going to happen where the way you were doing business, just for whatever reason, you've got to pivot. You've got to change. You've got to do something different. And you can spend your time, you've got a choice. You can spend your time wallowing in the mire and just feeling sorry for yourself and wishing that the old days were back. Or you can embrace it and go to work and understand that there are new opportunities out there that this is going to force you to find, and they'll probably be better than what you had before. And so those are the kinds of experiences that you've got to learn to embrace. You can worry about them if you want, that they're coming, because they are coming. But just be ready and understand that, hey, there's a reason for all of this. And there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that only comes because of the severe storm that was there before that. So lots of valuable lessons learned in that experience.
Jeez, those obstacles that are thrown our way, all we got to do is just pivot and find the opportunity. Love that mindset. You know, it's something I apply every day with business. So true. And you mentioned running. You need to tell the listeners your running habit and your stats for the past, what? I don't even know this stat. I forgot it. 40 years? Tell them what you do.
Well, it's longer than you've been alive.
This is ridiculous. Listen up to this.
Well, this goes back to 1991. June 10th, 1991. I just decided, you know, my father and grandfather, and you know, there's a family history of heart disease in my family, and I just decided I need to do whatever I can to stay in some reasonable shape. And so I said, okay, I'm going to start running. And I started running many times and stopped and started and stopped and started and stopped. And this time I said, okay, I'm just going to do it. I'm tired of the starting and stopping. I'm going to do it every day for 30 days. And I'm, no matter what, no matter how I feel, what time I got to bed at night or whatever it was, I'm going to run the next morning, except Sundays. I ran 6 days a week. And I'm going to do it for 30 days. I got to the end of 30 days. I did it. I said, oh, well, it wasn't so hard. Yeah, I'm going to do it for another 30 days. So I got to the end of 2 months and thought, well, that wasn't that hard. I'm going to do it for a year. I'm not going to miss no matter what. And I mean, you can't believe the stories along the way of different things that would happen. But the end of the year, I did it. I made it, which was quite an accomplishment. Didn't miss one single day.
And when you were sick, you just got up.
And I remember one night I played some basketball at the church the night before and turned my ankle on. I got the carpeted floors back in those days. They had carpet in the gymnasium. And I'm sick, thinking my streak's going to come to an end. How am I going to do this? And I, had ice on it all night long, and I got up in the morning and it had snowed like 4 or 5 inches of this really light, powdery, fluffy snow. We were living in Sandy at the time. So I went out and I said, I'm just going to do this. And so I just started running. The first quarter of a mile was pretty miserable, and you know, I wasn't moving very quickly. But the longer I went, the more it loosened up. And by the end of the run, I was back. I was running normally. But that snow was cushioning the blow.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've thought about that many times. Like, you know, it's if there's a will, there's a way. You know, you could just, I could have just stayed in bed and said, well, I tried, but, you know, I can't do this. And so revelation comes to those on the move. And if you just move forward, things, you can find ways to work. But anyway, to answer your question, and this is almost silly at this point, but I tell people and they'd look at me cross-eyed and think, you're crazy. But after the first year, I just said, I'm just going to keep going. And so it's been 32 years, and I haven't missed a day. And so...
32
knock
years.
Knock on wood. I would say that's been one of the most important things in my life is learning self-discipline and learning how to master myself, basically. Because if I could learn to be disciplined in that regard, I could learn that same kind of discipline in the other aspects of my life, and which has been unbelievably valuable to me, especially after years and years of stopping and starting various things, and then having to mount the charge again and start over again. It's too much work.
Mm.
It's just easier to just keep doing it.
Yeah.
And so, anyway,
gets easier as you go.
It does get easier as you go. I mean, it's like, yeah, I don't even think about it.
Yeah. So before we wrap up here, how can my listeners serve and support you?
Well, I'm not sure. if people were to ask me what kind of business I've been in most of my life, I would say the people business. I just love people, and what I really love about it is trying to help people, and I particularly love the younger generation, the youth and the young single adult age, young adults that are just getting started along the way. And I would, you know, there's so much out there, and your futures and your possibilities are just unbelievable. And you can accomplish anything that you can dream of if you'll just implement some of these things. And we haven't covered all of it, of course.
Might need another episode. Holy cow.
Just a fraction of it. But anyway, you know, do it. Follow your dreams. But understand, you're going to have to be very disciplined. You're going to have to work really, really hard. But you're going to need to trust in your Father in Heaven or your higher power or whatever your belief system is. There's a reason you're here on this planet having this experience. And find out what that is. And that will be a huge motivation and guide for you in your life.
It's powerful. You know, I appreciate your time today. There's just been so many gems. I absolutely loved it. I got to go back through and listen to it again on my own now. I appreciate your time. And I'm Caden Terry. And this has been the Psychology of Success.